there, you're listening to In the Books, a podcast where we overanalyze book-to-screen adaptations.
I'm Michelle. You can find me at Musings on the socials.
And I'm Rita. I'm at Annoying Rita on Instagram.
Welcome to our discussion of episode 11 of Normal People. If you've made it this far, you know we will be discussing plot points from the novel by Sally Rooney, and that the subject matter in these podcasts contain triggering material, usually about domestic violence and depression.
And we might throw in something else, who knows?
Yeah, tread lightly, my peeps. We will begin, as usual, with the recap.
Okay, so the episode begins in August. A much healthier looking Connell takes his antidepressants, yay, and heads back to work at the college's almost completely empty library. Truly the dream job. He then goes back to his room to send off a draft of his stories to Sadie, who runs the school's literary journal. You remember her. She was all like fangirling over Connell in one of the episodes. He has clearly got his mojo back. Meanwhile, back in Carrickley, Marianne is enduring a summer being hounded by her brother, who seems to enjoy following her around from room to room, criticizing her for breathing. She complains about his controlling behavior to Connell on one of his many, many weekend visits home. They're at the local beach. When she tells him he doesn't have to drive down to see her so much, he explains that it's pretty much the only thing he has to look forward to these days. Behind? What the hell did I mean? Marianne smiles, and then they go ahead and frolic on the beach together. The aesthetic is very Nicholas Sparks movie.
We cut to later in the summer. Marianne and Connell are dancing at the town's only club. They are maintaining eye contact, and you could cut the sexual tension with a knife. Not even a knife. I mean, like, maybe, you know, a chainsaw would work. Axe. I mean, it is thick and heavy. The next day, Marianne lies on Connell's bed, staring at the back of his head as he watches a GAA match on the TV. She slowly starts to drift off. Colin offers to drive her home at halftime, but she declines. She asks where he vanished to the night before at the club. He says he went to the smoking area. She asks if he kissed that girl, whoever that girl is, and he says no. She tells him that while he was gone, she ended up talking to Eric, who apologized for his behavior in school, and she forgave him.
Connell, see, I told you they were besties.
Yeah. Connell interrupts the conversation to go and get them a rocket ice lolly from the ice cream van on his road. When he gets back, he climbs next to her on the bed, and they both start licking away. It's incredibly suggestive. Marianne tells him that the people they went to school with have all been really nice to her over the summer. Connell suggests she make an effort to socialize with them, as it must be fairly lonely being back in Carrickley. Marianne reminds him that she's used to being lonely. She's been lonely her whole life, really. Connell says he understands. Marianne asks if he was lonely with Helen, and Connell admits he wasn't entirely able to be himself with her.
Marianne then shifts the conversation back to last night. She admits to feeling kind of awkward when he left her on the dance floor by herself and asks if he was annoyed with her. He tells her no, but that he thinks their friendship would be easier if, quote, certain things, unquote, were different. That's Connell Waldron speak for I wish I didn't fancy you so much, basically. Yes. Marianne understands and asks if he was ever lonely when they were together. Connell says no, and she tells him that she's never lonely with him. So cute! Connell says he looks back at their relationship as a perfect time in his life, which is wildly romantic for him. Marianne admits she wanted him to kiss her last night. He tells her he wanted to kiss her too, but she's now his best friend and he doesn't want to lose that. They don't exactly have the best track record, to say it, put it mildly, and he questions if their friendship could survive another round of heartbreak. Marianne feels rejected and gets up to leave, despite Connell explicitly telling her he isn't trying to reject her. She definitely feels rejected.
Mm-hmm.
They bicker back and forth over whether she's walking or he's driving her. Connell then grabs her hand, raises it to his lips, and gives her a little kiss. Marianne, you can literally see her melt.
Mm-hmm.
As Connell tells her, it's pretty obvious he doesn't want her to leave. Marianne's response should be tattooed across her forehead. Quote, I don't find it obvious what you want, end quote.
They kiss a lot. They begin to undress and they exchange the iconic lines, it's not like this with other people. I know, but I like you a lot more than other people. Which I think should be their wedding vows if they ever do anything so pedestrian as marry. They begin to have sex and Connell asks her if they could do it again next weekend. Marianne is
so hilarious.
Yes. Marianne is obviously down. But then the mood takes an immediate turn for the awkward when Marianne asks if he will hit her. Connolly, who is literally still inside her, has to say, no, actually, I'm not comfortable with that. This is understandably a bit of a mood killer, and he climbs off her to explain that he would find the situation weird.
Just like a little tiny pillow covering his genitals. Yes. It was all very awkward.
It's painfully adorable. Marianne interprets this as he thinks she is weird and begins to cry. She says she wants to leave now, and again he insists on driving her. The two of them get into a race to dress the quickest. Marianne wins and hurtles down the stairs and out of the house before Connell. Marianne walks home, sobbing, and Colin sits on his bed and weeps.
Connell.
When Marianne arrives home, her brother is waiting to pounce. He asks where she was, and when he learns she was at Connell's fucked in the head Waldron's house, he warns her to stay away from him. Alan, her brother, doesn't want people going around town saying a knacker is riding his sister.
I've never heard the expression knacker before, but
God,
I don't love it.
Marianne has never cared what other people think of her and tells him so. He throws a beer bottle towards her. He hurdles a beer bottle towards her, and she flinches in shock. We cut to the living room where her mother listens to the argument and does nothing. Marianne, sensing danger, runs past him and tries to flee into another room. She tries to close the door behind her, but it is flung open by Alan, whacking her straight in the face. Blood pools out of her nose.
Meanwhile, Connell is sat in his kitchen, nursing a beer, but instead of drinking himself into oblivion, he pours the contents down the drain. Excellent choice, my friend. His phone rings, and it's Marianne. She keeps apologizing profusely and tries to play it off, but admits that she has been hurt. Connell, sensing something is deeply wrong, just runs to his car and drives to her house as quickly as humanly possible. I'm sure he broke some laws that night.
Yeah.
When he arrives, Marianne answers the door. She's now just covered in blood. She tells him she thinks her nose is broken. Connell watches Alan slowly creep into the hallway in the background and asks Marianne if he did this. She nods. Connell orders her into his car. When she is gone, he then charges towards Alan and throws him into the wall, telling him that if he ever touches Marianne again, he will kill him.
Mm-hmm.
We then come back to Marianne's mother, who has obviously overheard everything. She looks slightly shaken, but again, she does not move, frozen in her position on the couch. Maybe there's a really good episode of TV on, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
Back in Connell's car, Marianne begins to apologize again. But Connell tells her not to. It's actually good she called him, and we all concur. Mm-hmm. He tells her to look at him. Marianne does, covered in blood, teary-eyed, and he promises that no one is ever going to hurt her like that again. He then tells her he loves her, and he won't let it happen. And then the episode ends with them driving away into the night together while some very moody music plays, and it's all very cool. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
Wow.
So So what did you think of another overly intense episode of Normal People?
Oh, God. I've been kind of dreading this episode because, you know, I've known that, you know, this episode would be the one where Alan wails on his sister. And I think that they handled it well, although if memory is serving me, it seemed to be even more intense in the book, you know, like...
I feel like everything is more intense in the book.
I mean, like, he hit her in addition to throwing the beer bottle at her and, you know, and before she ran upstairs to her room and winds up getting the door slammed in her face. I thought that the episode in its entirety was just fantastic. As usual, this show does not disappoint.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the best episodes of the season, and I say that every week. But I think it showcases a lot of the best aspects of the entire show.
Yeah,
and you know, for me personally, the best thing is like the super long scenes we get. Where, I mean, that conversation in the middle of the episode with Connell and Marianne in his bedroom is like 50% of the episode.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And I feel like the writing and the performances and the direction and even this like set design of that room really come together to produce something just amazing. And really, like, visually memorable. Like, I remember them sitting on that bed, licking those ice lollies. Like, it's iconic to me.
They looked really good. But
I told you, it's sexy.
Sure is. I thought that the episode was marvelous.
So the show's depiction of domestic violence is, I think... handled really well. The threat of violence is always there, but it never feels like gratuitous. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly at 4:30, but that's what I'm going with. Because when I compare it to the other way media have handled this subject matter, it's often far more exploitative.
Yeah,
you get black eyes and the typical thing, and I think that's because the novel and the show delved into kind of the more insidious behavior that people dismiss, but is abuse, you know, the constant belittling, the controlling behavior. I mean, even the moment where he tossed water on her, like it's not a moment of like graphic violence, but it was humiliating and awful.
Yeah.
And I like that they showed the build up and the escalation for years. Before they went to like the violence, because I think that's how most situations play out. And I think if we had just been seeing her get hit, like the classic one is being shoved into a wall. Like, I don't want to watch that.
Yeah.
I feel like they handled the violence delicately.
Yeah. I think that, you know, as you were talking about, it's almost like a progressive thing that happens, you know, and it's in with Alan's character, you know, we see every angle of what we would see in a domestic violent situation where you've got, you know, like psychological abuse, you've got physical abuse, you've got emotional abuse, you've got all of that. And I think that, you know, you said it very well. They have built up this, they've built this up over the course of the entire episode to this point. And it finally tips over the edge. And, you know, we have Connell coming in and confronting Alan, you know, and the actor who plays Alan is taller than Paul. But I mean, you could feel the power that was going on between the two of them, and the depth of Connell's protectiveness and anger, and how he was just very matter of fact and said, "You do anything like this again, I will kill you." It's like, oh yes, you are going to pay attention to that, kind sir.
He is, because it's a man saying it.
Mm-hmm. Because he's just an asshole.
He is.
Such an asshole.
He looked so shocked. I think it was the first time he'd been... Someone had ever stood up to him.
Yes.
Thank fucking God.
I think one of the things... I know that we touched a little bit on, you know, the book versus the episode... I thought that, you know, they, of course, once again, did a phenomenal job with the adaptation of the book to screenplay. And, you know, I think we've said it before that they allow this show and the material to breathe and have its space so that it can be as eloquent in the moments of silence as it is in the moments where we have dialogue.
There is room for awkwardness.
Yes. Yes. There had to be.
Because it was very awkward.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think part of the power of that is that it was a 12 episode run. We mm-hmm. may personally be finding the 12 episodes quite a struggle because taking up most of our year. But I think so many other times I've seen people try and condense a novel into 2 hours or 3 hours. And
it just does not work.
It just doesn't.
Does not work.
Well, it depends on the novel, but in terms of this one, I mean, this is so expansive and it covers so many years of their lives. It mm-hmm. would have been so bloody weird if they had made this into a movie. You would have got like 20 minutes or something in their high school years. And that would have really, like, you need time to dwell on the incredible major impact that has on the rest of their relationship. And I think whoever pitched this 12 half-hour episodes, really, you get it. Bravo.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
I will say there is something about the novel, this chapter in particular. I was rereading it this week. Not to brag, but I was on a beach, yay. I was rereading it on the beach, and I just cried in public. Yeah. That it's just something about being in their heads,
mm-hmm.
which mm-hmm. makes the scenes much more powerful emotionally and much more tragic. So I encourage anyone to read the novel because I think it does heighten the intensity. But it's also really nice to watch the show and the adaptation and have things like the background sound of the football match as they're talking to each other. And in the novel, there's like it's particular detail about the fizzing of Connell's Coke can and all that, and the mm-hmm. ice clinking around. And it's just like a throwaway line in the novel, and they recreated it perfectly mm-hmm. for the show.
Yeah.
And I just think like the level of detail that gives and just makes it feel like so authentic and real. Like mm-hmm. I feel like I've been in that tiny box room with them.
Mm-hmm.
And felt claustrophobic. That wallpaper makes the room look even smaller. What were you thinking, Lorraine?
Oh, you know, I think that, you know, what I want to do right away is to reread the book and just
don't,
you know,
do it in public. It's embarrassing.
No, I'm not going to do that. I was going to ask if you at least had some like very big fashionable dark glasses that you could hide behind while you were on the beach.
Yes, of course.
Yes,
of good. Course.
Excellent. Excellent.
I mean, I was still very like sniffly.
Oh man. That I really want to just listen to the book again and now that I've seen the show, just give myself the leisure to enjoy the book, because I think I was trying to catch up as quick as I could.
Yeah, you were like, what's going to happen next?
Exactly. And I think I would like to be able to sit a spell with it. This is by far one of my new favorite books. And I'll probably be getting a copy of the paperback to just have in my library, because I just loved it so much.
Yay.
Yeah.
The cover with the paperback has Marianne and Connell cuddled up in a sardine can. Which I love visually. I love that. Okay, depressing time. So Marianne's relationship with Alan, and Alan in general, has definitely been spiraling and all summer, and his behavior was escalating. In the novel, when Connell confronts him, Alan just begins to weep and beg for forgiveness in a kind of really pathetic way.
Yeah.
That reminded me of like a school bully or like a child when they finally get a taste of their own medicine. I kind of wish we got to see that in the show, because I think it makes the character seem more well-rounded.
Yeah.
Also reminds you that he's acting out generational trauma and blah, blah, blah. I always go on about this. I just think he's very well written. I think it's also another aspect of the novel we have to praise, that this figure isn't just like some big scary monster, but he's like a loser that people pity and also despise in equal measure. Like, he's just some guy who is acting out his frustration on his sister, and it's just sad and pathetic.
Yeah.
And he needs help.
Yeah, he does. You know, it is, I think, a credit to the gentleman who is playing Alan, you know, who, you know, we saw in Sanditon with his little Scottish accent.
I know, he's definitely Irish.
But... he's definitely Irish. He did an amazing job with a very difficult character. You know, I appreciate the places that he had to go in order to be able to deliver a performance like that.
Talk about range as an actor, that he can go from Alan to Austin hero.
Yeah. Yes. I thought that he was a particularly well-rounded character. I'd forgotten that he basically breaks down and starts sobbing, because I agree with you, it would have been absolutely wonderful to get that as well. But I think what we got works quite well, especially with the two of them, Connell and Alan, playing off one another in that moment. The intensity was just electric.
There's always the chance that they tried it, and in the moment it felt kind of phony.
Yeah.
You never know. There's a chance that it would have been overkill. You definitely get the sense that he's shocked. He looks like a teenage boy who's just been confronted. Like, he doesn't look like a grown man who's angry.
Who's been sauntering around bullying his sister for years. He's like, and years.
Who, me?
Yeah.
It's classic.
Just, it's like, wow, all the air went out of your sails now, didn't it, pumpkin?
Which is like, I think, exactly what would happen. What I found interesting was the shot of her mother listening in on events.
Wasn't that just brilliant?
Some of the best shots of the episode for me. Like, that actress is amazing.
Oh my gosh.
She was able to express so much. In a very dimly lit ass room for like 3 split seconds, you were like, she's good.
Yeah. I was, you know, I know that my feelings towards Marianne's mother have not been all that kind over the course of our
justifiably
show. But you know something? I found myself really feeling sorry for her. Oddly. I mean, I caught myself going, where is this sympathy coming from? And I think where it came from was the fact that, you know, we are witnessing, you know, what happens when you have this level of generational trauma that happens in a family. You know, I'm sure that for her, you know, the minute she's hearing Alan, you know, going off, she must have had a moment of absolute terror and things reminding her of when she was married to their father. And, you know,
she looked frozen, literally.
She looked frozen. Scared. Yeah, she looked frozen and absolutely petrified. And it made me think, God, has he wielded this power over her throughout the entire time frame that we are in this show? And I think that the answer, at least for me, was yes.
Yes. And I don't know that it's necessarily even conscious.
Oh, no.
It's that she's so traumatized, mm-hmm. that she has been sort of frozen in shock in this, mm-hmm. She's very cold and unfeeling,
mm-hmm.
because of the trauma, I think.
Mm-hmm.
She's just been frozen in shock and just survival mode. And she's not able to even really, she's not very well equipped to be a mother, which sounds harsh, but she can't function in a way to protect someone else because she's can't protect herself. She still feels frozen. And I feel so much sympathy for that, but also there is a level of I feel like she's fully complicit in the abuse that Marianne has suffered for years. And I really like that the show chose to do this, because in the book she's not at home. Mm-hmm. So they've obviously made this conscious choice to include her mother in this moment.
Yeah.
And the way they did it was to highlight how scared and frozen she is. Mm-hmm. It's like the only word I can think. She just looked like she'd been, you know, the Harry Potter movies where you're frozen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what she looked like. So yes. The kind of shock and scared, mm-hmm. expression on her face. I like that they chose to include her, because I think she's an important part of that whole dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem for Marianne has always been that she feels like her mother should have intervened and said something. I think maybe after years of therapy, Marianne will be able to look back and say, oh, my mother was just unable to do that because of her own history of abuse.
Yeah.
But in that moment, she needed her mother to stand up, mm-hmm. for her, and she wasn't able to. And that's going to, of course, be horrible for her.
Yeah. That will mess with her for many years. And like you
it's
said,
okay.
Hopefully...
Colin knows a therapist. We're going to be fine.
Yes. I was going to say, check in with Colin's therapist or Colin's therapist and, get to work on that, because you'll be much happier once you come to a resolution of that. I thought it was those shots of her mother were absolutely brilliant, and I exclaimed when I saw her. I was like, oh. when I saw her appear on screen, and I was like, oh my God, just made my throat tight. You know, I have since been able to temper the sympathy that I was feeling for her with some righteous indignation. so you know, it's like,
but
I
love
her,
the complexity of both, though, mm-hmm. that you can have both things simultaneously.
Absolutely.
Of like, I do feel bad for her. Mm-hmm. I also think she has completely fucked up everyone's life.
Yeah.
Also, Alan's.
Mm-hmm.
She had intervened when he was younger. and said, you know, I know Alan was probably witness and victim mm-hmm. to a lot of abuse as a child, and got him some help when he started acting out like this, because this has been going on. But, you know, like I said, she's complicit.
Mm-hmm.
It's everyone in that family was fucked up by the actions of the father. It's so interesting that he's, like, not there.
Yeah.
You know, he's nowhere dead
now, to be seen.
But he's the root cause of all their problems.
Mm-hmm.
And they have those yearly masses for him.
Yeah.
And everyone probably talks about that family, because mm-hmm. there's definitely rumors.
Oh, of course.
It's just so tragic.
Yeah.
That man really just fucked up everyone.
It is just messed up. Oh,
it's so sad.
So, Mr. Connell.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. The difference between what we saw last week and what we saw this week was like night and day. He looked clear-eyed. He looked healthy.
Bushy-tailed.
Yeah, bushy-tailed. He looked healthy. He looked like he was really kind of
functional.
Yeah.
Not lying on the floor.
Yeah. It's amazing what a good therapist and some antidepressant SSRIs, medication
yeah.
can do for you. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I like that they included the shot of him taking his medication.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, despite the destigmatization that we've got surrounding mental health recently, there's still a lot of nonsense out there about antidepressants.
Oh, yeah.
I see so many posts where, like, you don't need meds. You can cure your depression with sunlight. Go out for a walk. And, like, I get that that happens because the American pharmaceutical industry is corrupt as fuck. But I can assure you that in Europe, it's very hard to get prescribed anything.
Wow. So
if he's been prescribed anything.
Mm-hmm.
God. And Connell is definitely a case where he definitely fucking needs it, because man, it has severe depression and chronic anxiety. And, like, I remember in the book, there's, like, when he takes the test, she's like, oh, anybody who has, like, a mild depression gets a score between like 14 and 16.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a score of like 46.
Yeah. I remember, yeah, I was like, yeah.
I remember snorting. I was like, yes, son, you need help.
Yeah, the phrase off the charts was born for you.
Yeah, hon, you're like the cliche. You need help.
You know, I find that kind of sad that getting prescribed antidepressants over in your neck of the woods is a difficult thing.
Well, because there is a thing, like, getting prescribed anything is hard. I don't just mean, like, antidepressants. I think just getting some antibiotics is hard, because their first inclination is always to say, you know, if there's, go out and exercise, try mm-hmm. talk therapy, try all these different methods,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll see if you need medication.
God.
Which I think is actually, for most cases, some people will really need the medication, mm-hmm. but some people will just be like, hey, you haven't, like, tried the basic things that you need mm-hmm. to function as a human, mm-hmm. like drinking water and eating your food, and, like, self-care, mm-hmm. Basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing what eating a balanced diet will do to just help you feel better. And, you know, doing the work to kind of rule out, you know, anything else that might be going on is, you know.
Sleeping.
Yeah.
Fucking sleeping is the biggest thing you can do to change your mental health.
Getting enough sleep.
The first things whenever I get into a depressive episode that goes is my sleep. Mm-hmm. So to, like, self-regulate that, I usually get like 2 weeks worth of sleeping pills. Very specific. Because they don't give you sleeping pills as well, uh-huh. unless it's really severe. They'll give you like 2 weeks worth of sleeping pills to sort of get you into a pattern of sleeping at night.
Yeah.
And then you get into a routine. Routines will save your life, I swear to fucking God.
Oh my God,
go to bed
yes.
at this time, you wake up at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I say at 5:12 in the morning.
And oh, but it's
it regulates
true.
It regulates your brain chemistry.
Yeah, it is absolutely true. You know, I know that I have been feeling better ever since, you know, I've gone on to a fairly strict schedule of sleep. Even on the weekends, you know, I'm not staying up until midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning and then sleeping, you know, all morning long to kind of try and make up for that. You know, it is imperative that I am in bed at 9 and I am up and out at 5:30. And, you know, so that's if I don't do that.
I think like you have to do all the really boring shit, like sleeping, exercising, fresh air, eating vegetables with like every day.
Yep. the antidepressants are not, they're not, you know, the be all and end all. They just help with the brain chemistry, aspects of things that need to get, rewired. And, you know, for some people, you know, it is a situational depression and, you know, they're able to, you know, eventually get off of the medication. You know, for others, you know, they know that they need to keep taking them, which is the thing that makes medications for mental and behavioral health issues so challenging, because, you know, you take the medications and you feel better and you think, oh, I don't need to take these medications anymore. And so you go off of them and then you feel like crap. And then you go through this cycle over and over and over again. You do that enough times and you, you know, realize I have to ignore the fact that I am feeling better. You know, that can play in the background, but, you know, I can't be side-eyeing the prescriptions and saying, I don't need those anymore.
Yeah, like, for some people, situational depression, they're able to work through it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are unfortunate to have really shitty serotonin levels,
yeah,
you can't fix that with hopes and dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You need help. And I think, like, we don't think about people who take medication for diabetes or anything. Like, they have imbalanced hormones. They take medication for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this stigma around taking SSRIs that I don't understand. Like, I need the serotonin, babes. I cannot function. Another thing I really liked was the moment where Connell was sat at the kitchen table with his beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like,
dude, you really
where
shouldn't
have
be
we seen
having
this exact
that.
shot before?
Yeah, it's like, dude, you really probably should not be having that beer right now.
And he listened.
Yes.
When I said no.
And he dutifully poured it down the sink. And I was really happy because I knew that phone call from Marianne was coming. And Lord knows we didn't need him on the road after he's had a beer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Therapy works, people. Okay.
Yeah, it does.
Because he was able to see this pattern of, oh, I usually drink myself into oblivion when I'm unhappy. And he was like, oh, I'm not going to do that this time.
Yeah.
Ooh. And thank God, yeah, like you said, because he wouldn't have been able to drive.
Yeah.
And choices matter.
Yeah. So with our dear darlings, Marianne and Connell, ruining the friendship with romance.
Yes. So this is like a big deal in the novel because you're in Connell's perspective at that moment and he's having a full-on spiral. Do you think his fears are well-rounded, founded? Because I was like, You know what, boy? You have a point.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. You know, as messed up as their communication has tended to be, you know, we saw evidence of that in the episode. You know, he uses the word weird and, you know, off Marianne goes, you know, on her own little spiral. And so I think that Connell knows that he needs Marianne in his life. And if they can't manage to be in an intimate relationship, he wants to remain friends with her at all cost.
That's his bestie.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. You know what was probably a good sign, though, was when they were able to talk about the misunderstanding at the club.
Yes.
For like the first time, I was so proud of them.
And, you know, we didn't need to have months and months go by before they were able to have that conversation. You know,
I was thinking if that had happened in episode 4 or 5.
Oh, my God.
They would never speak again.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So they are better at communicating. Mm-hmm. They're not perfect, obviously. Yeah. I do have a feeling like maybe the next day, as soon as he gets on the phone with her, he wants to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do feel like they are able to get there eventually. And also just like practicing it makes them better at it. Mm-hmm. This is like communicating is new for them. Yeah. They usually just stew in their feet, like depressive little babies.
But yeah.
But yeah, if I was him, I would be terrified and potentially never make my move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that has always made me uncomfortable in any show or movie is like the cliche of the man rescuing the woman. But I think in this case, I'm cool with it. Because I feel like it was important character growth. Marianne was always, always, always looking for a demonstration or just a very clear flashing sign of his affection. And, you know, she got a really explicit one. Like, here you go. He even says the words unprompted.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely a breakthrough moment for him.
Yeah. He's looking her dead in the eye. There's not, you know, it is, you know, not something that is like whispered in the moment or anything like that. He's just very matter of fact, because I love you. It's just like, damn, okay.
17-year-old Connell could never. He would have been like,
oh, God.
I love you, I guess, maybe.
No, he has really made some amazing strides through the course of this show. And
I think for Connell as well, I think he needed this moment because he had felt so much guilt about her low self-esteem. Because he definitely feels like, oh, I fed into that. And this was an opportunity for him to break this whole pattern she has where she feels like she's responsible for what happens to her when she's mistreated. And he was here to say, no, I finally get an opportunity to right this wrong and say, you don't deserve this and I'm going to stop it. It was like good growth for both of them.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of love this show. Love this show so much.
It's so good, right?
Oh, man. Thank you for browbeating me into it.
I know you were reluctant, but I'm always correct. And I think you need to realize this.
Yes, Rita's always right.
Can we get that on a t-shirt?
Yeah.
Merch drop.
It's rawr. Rita's always right.
Ooh. And then we can do like a tiger.
Yes.
That looks like me with the glasses. And okay. Favorite performance.
Well, what's Connell reading?
Oh, yeah, I forgot Connell's reading.
He had some books this week.
Okay, so books I could see in Connell's room. And bear in mind that I was pausing during some scenes where people were undressing. It was weird. Okay, so Temples of Delight, Barbara Trepido is on his windowsill. So that's this like really weird, quirky coming of age story about a girl named Alice who makes a life altering friendship with a girl named Jeb. And it kind of dissolves into a complete nonsense towards the end, bizarrely Catholic overtones that I don't really want to talk about. But overall, I think it's an interesting choice for Connell because it's very much about how a friendship can change a life.
Mm-hmm.
On brand for him. There's also a copy of Fanny, a 1931 play by French writer Marcel Pagnol.
Mm-hmm.
The question mark after how I pronounce that? Pagnol. It's the second part of a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
It begins with Marius and concludes with Caesar. Okay, so the story takes place in Marseille. That's in France, people.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first play, Marius has this romance with his best friend. Her name is Fanny.
Mm-hmm.
So you see.
But sensing a theme here.
Yes. But then he desires a life of adventure. He actually becomes a sailor. It's all very weird. And he goes out to... bit of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Across, sail the ocean, across the world, blah, blah, blah. So in this play, that's the ending of the first play. It's like, oh, they have this romance. They think they're going to get married, but then Marius is like, leaves. So in the second play, which is the one we're talking about, Fanny,
mm-hmm.
Fanny discovers she's pregnant by Marius, which is obviously a shameful position. Because unmarried women,
yeah.
It's France, it's the early 20th century,
mm-hmm.
That's a problem. So she marries a prosperous salesman in the harbour. His name is Honoré, who's 30 years older than she is.
Oh, which dear. Is,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So a few months after she has married him, she gives and given birth to the baby that is Marius, is confusing, can you keep up? Marius returns from his ocean adventure and tries to win back Fanny, and she's all like, bitch, I'm married. It gets really messy. And I think the third play is, I haven't read that one, is from Honoré's perspective.
Okay.
Because he's all like, oh, I love my wife, but she had this whole history with Marius.
This man. Seafaring
nonsense.
Now he's come back and he's trying to mess with my world.
And then you got to remember, that kid is going to find out that Marius
mm-hmm.
is his dad.
Mm-hmm.
The drama.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. Kind of reminds me of the Count of Monte Cristo, you know, with...
it's all French, isn't it? That counts.
yeah. But yeah, we have the secret child of the hero and all that other kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Oh. Who's the daddy? what's the name of the guy who does paternity checks on TV in America? I've never seen an episode in my life.
Maury something. I can't remember his last name.
We needed him. Sort this shit out.
Yeah.
Okay,
favorite performances.
So this is hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought Daisy Edgar Jones sort of edged out Paul this week. There's that moment where he says, look at me, and she just lifts up her face and stares at him,
mm-hmm.
and she's covered in like blood.
Yeah.
Teary-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
But her expression is just like frightened, mixed with love and relief, and just like four different things going on.
Yeah, it was just, they had me on the edge of my seat with their performances this week. I thought that, you know, it was hard. At one point I was yelling at them. I was like, okay, I can't have both of you crying at the same time.
When she's crying, walking across the field and he's on the bed, I was just like, oh, God.
I'm like, oh, God, I can't take this. She was pretty amazing. And, you know, like watching her face shift from... passion when they are making love and she's, you know, asking him or basically telling him that he can do whatever he wants with her, you know, and she says, you know, will you hit me? And, you know, in that moment, she is clearly in a passionate state. But then when he answers her, you can just see her, you see crumple. Her face just crumple apart with all of the emotions that must have been racing through her in that moment. It was really awards. These people needed awards, damn it.
Pull one a BAFTA.
That's nice.
Where is Daisy Edgar Jones's BAFTA? Giving a better performance than... No actress was doing better work that year than her. This is where I find out it was like Meryl Streep. Who she went up against. I don't know, but I just think like this is such an intense role and she's doing amazing work.
Yeah.
You know you haven't given an answer. You just skillfully avoided saying who your favorite.
Oh, my favorite, Daisy. I was going to give it to her as well. She, the scene with the two of them as she's falling apart, and then the scene with her and Alan when Alan hurls that bottle of beer at her, and the look of horror on her face. She was amazing this week. Not like she's been shirking on her duties the rest of the time, because clearly that's not the case. But this week was just chef's kiss.
Favorite scenes?
Well, aside from the obvious, I always do enjoy those intimacy coordinated scenes that they have done so well. The entire scene in his room. I thought that was probably one of the best scenes in the entire show, because we had such a long time in that space. It almost felt like we were seeing a play.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
we watch so many shows where like the scenes are 3 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move on. And by the way, that is absolute fucking nightmare when I'm writing a recap. Can everyone stop editing their shows to shit? My attention span is not that short, okay?
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. How about you?
That scene is incredible. Yeah, I would say that scene, definitely, obviously. Like, the thing is, it encompasses, like, half the episode. So I think, other than that incredible scene, I actually really like the scene of them driving in the dark around the country lane.
Yes,
I got like goosebumps watching that. I thought, happened in my head. The episode ended with them getting in the car, and then I was watching the end like, wow, why is this powerful? They're just driving. But I think it's a combination of the cinematography.
It was just beautiful. It was beautiful. I remember that you mentioned once that there was a scene where they were driving that you really liked. And so when I saw that final scene, hearing you say that reminded me of, or the scene reminded me of hearing you say that. And I found myself just falling madly in love with the way that was shot. And, you know, I think if I remember correctly, David Byrne is the person that is singing in that song. And so you have his very high, clear voice coming through. It was really beautiful. Just beautiful.
Something about the way they shot it was like they were like escaping through a labyrinth of country lanes that just was like,
yeah.
Wow,
and you know, the darkness of their two figures in the seat and night all around them with this brilliant green in front of them. It was just glorious.
I love the show.
Yeah, me too.
So in terms of costumes, can we just talk about the fact that Marianne was dressing like a normal person?
Yes. Except when she went to the club and then she was back in her, you know, like Studio 54 disco kind of mode, but which I thought she pulled off.
I'm sorry,
and it was
but that
really
is classic
cool.
Millennial. That is jeans and a nice top. That is jeans and a very nice top. She's one of us now. This episode she was wearing a jean skirt and a tank top. Just a blue tank top. Elaborate 1960s sundress mm-hmm. with vintage jewelry.
Yeah.
She's just a person in clothes.
She's just a girl in Carrickley.
That's like a positive sign for her, don't you think? Mm-hmm. She's not
putting on a costume anymore.
She's just wearing clothes. Mm-hmm. Who are you trying to impress?
Yeah. She's not going with a shtick. She is being herself.
We love to see it.
Yeah. Locations and photography. I love the beach shot, although I it looked so cold. And I know it was Island. Like, okay, it's supposed to be in August. Okay, I get that, but
even in August, that's the Atlantic, babes. It's yeah. Not gonna be warm.
Gonna say your little feet are gonna turn blue. But I love the scene at the ocean.
Again, very Nicholas Sparks movie. We just mm-hmm. needed somebody to start singing on a piano.
You know,
somebody to get cancer.
I have never seen one of the Nicholas Sparks movies.
I mean, if you've ever seen the poster for the movie, you've seen the movie. It's two attractive white people on a beach. Okay?
Oh, dear.
That's the movie. And then somebody peripherally, or one of the main characters, dies. Oh, that's it. Someone has to die. That is the code, too.
I think I am resisting seeing The Notebook just on principle. It's like, no.
My hot
not
take
do
is
it.
That A Walk to Remember is the only one worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
I just love Mandy. Mandy Moore is a good egg. Okay. What were we talking about?
Okay, sorry. Any other
locations? Okay, shout out to Connell's box room, because there were like these little cuts that you can see how he's decorated his room. Mm-hmm. You've got like cutouts of Gaelic football players and postcards from all the places he traveled to in the previous summer, like Berlin and things like that. And of course, all the books that I am mentioning. It just feels like somewhere that someone lives in. It reminds me of actual rooms that I have been in mm-hmm. as a teen. Mm-hmm. And there's something about how small that room is, with the cupboard that leans into his bed and like takes up the headspace, and it's kind of awkward. It's just heightened the tension of that whole scene.
Yeah.
When they're crammed onto the bed awkwardly together.
Yeah.
Like, it's just perfectly set designed. just love it.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Anything you didn't like?
Nothing.
Yeah. Same here.
Just should have taken this question out.
Yeah, honestly, it's like this show, there has not been a single thing that I haven't liked in this show. How many, do we even need to ask how many Communist Manifestos out of 5?
I always assume we're giving it a 5.
Yeah.
I remember at one point I was giving the show 4.5, and I regret that. I should have just been giving them 5s the whole time.
Yeah, this is a 5, and another 5.
Just, next week will be a 5, I promise you that.
Okay, good, because, you know, I don't want to be disappointed, and at this point, I don't think that they will, but...
be pretty impossible to do that at this
point.
I also feel like this episode serves as like actual end
mm-hmm.
and next episode feels more like an epilogue of
an
like,
epilogue. Okay.
I think so.
Okay. I can go with
inbox.
That.
Yeah. Isn't it nice that they have, they're like, this is the height of the tension.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're gonna gently rock you out of this.
Yes.
Unlike most shows we watch, which is like, okay, it's done now, bye.
Yeah.
Or in case of Sanderton, let's give you a 5-second montage of mm-hmm. everyone.
Everything
not really
getting resolved. Bye. Yeah.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Anyway, inbox time.
Yes.
So, subject line. Obviously, we need to talk about Alan and, more importantly, Marianne's mother.
Ah, here we go.
All illusions of the dysfunctional family life that Marianne has endured is on full display in this episode, explicitly. Unfortunately, her mother is perpetuating the cycle by ignoring her son's behavior, but that doesn't excuse Alan's actions. I'm interpreting the tears in Alan's eyes when Connell confronts him as an indication that he does actually know, on some level, what he is doing is wrong, but perhaps he obviously doesn't have the skills, ability, mental fortitude to stop his behavior. Again, I'm not excusing him. He's also a victim of his ongoing abuse subject within the family. Denise, her mother, however, I initially thought perhaps she was also paralyzed by the event unfolding before her, and in some regards she is, but her reaction doesn't really feel like that. I'm more likely to think she was perhaps hoping to keep out of the way of the tirade that she knew was coming. Mm. She was just sitting and waiting it out. The thing I have an issue with is that Denise had her whole life, especially after the death of her father, to engage and try to change the potential outcomes. She was the person to stand up and protect her children. Perhaps she did in some ways by taking the brunt of their father's abuse, but it wasn't enough, obviously. Some might say I'm blaming her. I guess I am, to a degree. However, she's an intelligent woman with presumably the means to access help, unlike a lot of the other women in her village and area. Believe me, I can understand her reluctance to act while her husband was alive, but since he's been dead, really, especially after she witnesses all the vile verbal abuse her son inflicts on her sister. I mean, she should have been up and in that hallway as soon as she heard the bottle smash. I just can't deal with it. I guess my own mothering instincts are being riled up here. I do understand it's a complicated situation to be in, and Denise is equally damaged by it all. But come on, this would have been the time to stand up and call Alan out. Thank goodness for Connell and his good heart to come to Marianne's rescue. Finally, we can show her how much he does love her and wants to protect her in a very real and genuine way. As for Marianne and Connell, there are some key phrases. I don't find it obvious what you want. Marianne's not able to read Connell at times. I love that line. She said like a variation of that like a number of times throughout the show.
Yeah.
My other favorite line is, who is it obvious to? Oh, Marianne, never change.
Yes.
Another quote. It was the happiest time of my life, really. I was never lonely with you. It's not like this with other people. I like you way more than other people. But most importantly, I really want to like post some of these lines on Instagram, by the way, but they're mostly naked in them and we would get banned.
Yeah.
So damn you normal people. Put some clothes on. But most importantly of all, Connell's last statement whilst looking Marianne in the eye with no ambiguity this time and telling her he loved her and no one would ever hurt her again and to trust him. God, I hope they can take the leap of faith to keep each other close and loved. But you never know with these stories. Fingers crossed. Ciao, Maria. Oh,
thanks, Maria. Dear Rita and Michelle, Debbie from New York City here. Really enjoying the podcast and hearing your analysis of normal people. All the work you do for the podcast is seen and appreciated. I've watched the series several times, but always learned something new from the two of you. Episode 11 is among my favorites, as difficult as it is to watch. What a long way these two characters have come. Just 3 years earlier in high school, Connell sat by in silence when his friends verbally abused Marianne. He has matured and can no longer stay silent. He will not tolerate it, period. The confidence and surety with which he tells Alan to stop right now is beautiful to witness. We've never seen Connell be anything other than sweet and gentle, so a flash of anger from him packs an emotional punch. I love his words to Marianne in the car, and I believe him, and I think Marianne does too, that no one will ever hurt her like that again. He has just broken the cycle of abuse in Marianne's familial life. He is her family now, regardless of what happens between them romantically in the future. The performances in this episode are phenomenal. I don't know if this kind of detail would have been in the script or if it was Daisy Edgar Jones's choice, but in that scene in the car at the end when Connell says, "Look at me a second," When Marianne looks at Connell, that involuntary smile flashes across her face, even in the worst moment of her life. That same involuntary smile has made an appearance a few other times in previous episodes, most notably for me when Connell first arrives at the villa in Italy in episode 8. Marianne is outside folding the sheets, and when she turns around to say hello, the moment she lays eyes on Connell, we see that flash of a smile across her face. Well done, Daisy Edgar Jones. Paul Mescal is equally impressive yet again in this episode. When he's sitting on his bed sobbing after their disastrous sexual encounter, it felt so relatable. We've all sobbed like that in private, but yet again, Paul Mescal is willing to lay himself bare on camera for all of us to witness. I don't envy you having to pick a favorite performer this week. They were both incredible. Looking forward to the final two episodes of this podcast series, although I'm sad it's coming to an end. I will listen to it all the way through again, as I did with season 2 of Bridgerton. Thanks again for all the hard work. Debbie, your fan in New York City. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you, Debbie. That was a beautifully written email.
That was
and she
lovely.
Gave us a coffee. Thank you, Debbie.
Oh, she did. Oh, thank you.
Oh, Debbie, you're anyone who gives us money is our favorite.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Episode 12 summary. In their final year in Trinity, Marianne and Connell are back together.
Woo!
That sounded like a ghost. That was excitement, but I'm, you know, it's 5 a.m. But whether their relationship will endure after they graduate is uncertain. Boo. Okay, so if you're reading along with the show, then just read to the end.
Yeah.
You don't need chapters this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
Uh-huh. Okay, folks, that's all for this episode. We will be back next week discussing the final episode. If you want to get involved in the podcast, you can email us at inthebooksnetwork@gmail.com. We are on Insta, so please follow if you want fun bonus content and updates on the podcast. If you enjoyed the pod, please rate, review, and tell your friends. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time. Bye!
Bye.
Turn around, round, round.